Hey there, I'm so pumped to tell you about an amazing new community I've launched called Grief to Growth Circle Community. It's a space for people who are grieving to come together to support each other and for people who want to know who we are, why we're here, and where we're going to have those conversations, all the things we talk about on the podcast. So I invite you to join me at grieftogrowth.com/community to become part of this compassionate crew. The best part is 100% free. And you have access to me in addition to everybody else in the community. In fact, the podcast will be there so you can talk about the things we talk about in the podcast right there in the community. There's also some premium content if you want to go deeper in the work I'm doing, but mostly it's about building relationships and community and about sharing resources and supporting each other. So come on over and check it out. It's grieftogrowth.com/community. I'll see you inside.
Hi there. Welcome to Grief to Growth Podcast. Your host is Brian Smith, spiritual seeker, best-selling author, grief survivor, and life coach. Brian believes that the worst tragedies of life provide the greatest opportunity for growth. Brian says he was planted, not buried, and he is here to help you grow where you've been planted by the difficulties in life. In each episode, Brian and his guests will share what has helped them to survive and thrive. It is his sincere hope this episode helps you today.
Hey, everybody, this is Brian back with another episode of Grief to Growth. And today I've got with me Kelvin Chin. And Kelvin has a very interesting and rich background. I'm going to read his bio to give you an idea of who he is. He's a life after life expert, a stress management and meditation teacher, is a grief recovery specialist. He's the executive director and founder of the Turning Within Meditation and Overcoming the Fear of Death Foundations. He's an internationally recognized meditation teacher, featured in Business Insider, Newsweek, Kaiser Health News, and has taught meditation at West Point and the U.S. Army, including on the DMZ in Korea. Kelvin is also the author of the best-selling Overcoming the Fear of Death through each of the four main belief systems, which is the book we're going to talk about today. And it's a non-religious approach to the four beliefs that underlie all religious and cultural beliefs. He has had many experiences piercing the veil over the last 35 years, communicating with the other side, as we call it, and his past life memories reach back 6,500 years. Kelvin has been meditating for 50 years and has taught meditation for 46 years to thousands of people from age 4 to 94 in over 30 countries. He regularly helps clients with PTSD, anxiety, depression, and sleep disorders, especially those who have lost loved ones or had traumatic spiritual experiences. His technique is easy and effortless with no culture or lifestyle trappings and offers a solution that helps people live their lives more fully now, giving them a sense of greater control to move forward. He was a featured speaker on opening night at the 2019 IANS conference in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and has spoken at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, Yale, Dartmouth, and healthcare firms, and is scheduled to speak at the Spirit University Helping Parents Heal Maui, East-West Bookshop, IANS Santa Barbara, IANS South Bay, and IANS Boulders, and others. Kelvin is a graduate of Dartmouth, Yale, and Boston Law College, and has lived in 7 countries. So as I said, that is quite a resume. I'm not sure how much we'll get through in the conversation today. But yeah. With that, I want to welcome Kelvin Chin.
Thank you so much, Brian. I really appreciate being here.
Yeah, it's really great to meet you. As I was telling you before we started, I've seen your name. I've heard you before. We were introduced by a mutual friend, Lilia, who suggested that I bring you onto the podcast.
Yeah.
And you were kind enough to send me your book. I'm going to show the book here. It's Overcoming the Fear of Death. Through each of the four main belief systems. And I got this in the mail on Saturday. I thought there's no way I'm going to have time to get it read before our interview on Tuesday. I read it on Sunday. I read the whole thing in the day on Sunday. It's a cool. Great book. It's a really easy read. I love the approach that you take. And one of the things I wanted to say, though, when I saw through each of the four main belief systems, I was thinking maybe those were like religious systems, like Buddhism, right. Hinduism, and but it's not. It's four cultural and beliefs that we all hold. So let's talk about those. What are the four main belief systems?
Sure. Yeah. My approach, as you said, is non-religious, and I'm trying to be as open as possible for people from all cultures, all religions, and including atheists and agnostics. So in other words, people who are not religious in an organizational kind of way. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about this years ago, And because I would have conversations with people and they would get into who's right and who's wrong about their perspectives about death and dying. And I thought, we need to talk more about this because this is the elephant in the room that nobody talks about, right? And so how can we talk more about it without getting into stuck in religious and cultural beliefs? So I came up with these four beliefs. So the four beliefs are, the first one is what you could call the scientist belief. So one life, the brain and the mind or consciousness or spirit or soul, those are all synonymous as far as I'm concerned. The brain and the mind are connected. That's it. When the brain, physical body dies, that's it. The mind shuts off. That's the first belief system. Second belief system is, I call it the fear of continued existence. So that's where people believe that there is going to be some continued existence, and they may define it in different ways depending on religion and philosophy and culture and so forth. But they do believe that the mind will continue in some form. But there's some fears about it, and the fears could be due to all kinds of different reasons. But there's some concern, fear about what may happen after they physically die. Third belief system is also a belief in an afterlife, we'll call it, that the mind does continue after the physical body dies, but there's no fear. So they may even be looking forward to it. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then the fourth belief system that really exists, you know, out there in the world, in a lot of the world, outside the United States, is the belief in reincarnation, past lives, future lives, the idea that the mind is conscious and can redirect itself into another body and have another lifetime, not as Brian or Kelvin, but as somebody else, whatever, they got a different physical form, but that something continues that is identifiable about, you know, underlying who Brian is and underlying who Kelvin is. So that's the fourth belief system. And everybody falls somewhere in there. And some people are hybrids. I call them fence sitters, and that's okay. Yeah. I think I'm a little bit this one, a little bit that one. I'm not sure. And that's fine. But I think it's good to kind of think about where you are in that spectrum, and it helps you clarify your thinking. And if you have any fears, I think that's the first step I take with people when I talk with them to find out where they're at when I'm trying to help them reduce their fears about death and dying.
Yeah, I really, the approach you take in the book, I think is, I really appreciated it because, as you said, you kind of break these categories down and people can kind of choose where they are. And then you address each one of the categories and what the fears are and whether rational or not. Right. And really the first step is understanding. And you talk about in the book about understanding versus inspiration. Right. So could you talk about that for a while?
Well, yeah, I think because I thought about, you know, what already exists out there. And I didn't want to just say the same old stuff that everybody else already is being helped by. Mm-hmm. And so there is an inspirational approach to helping people. And there's nothing wrong with it. I was just trying to figure out how could I be different and fill in a gap. Mm-hmm. And so the inspirational approach is more like, I'm so sorry about your loss. You know, and you embrace them from an emotional standpoint. There's an emotional, energetic, a genuine connection with the person on that level, et cetera. And, mm-hmm. and there's lots of books and there's lots of workshops and there's many professional people doing that kind of work with people. So, you know, I thought, well, what's missing in here is perhaps a different way of looking at death and dying from an understanding standpoint. And that's what made me think about the four belief systems. And then you kind of get on different perspectives and you kind of look at it from their perspective, because I have my own belief system, but that's irrelevant with my clients. You know, I'm trying to help them where they are. I'm the guy who try to help them get from point A to point B, not where I am. You know, it's where they are. It's what matters. Right.
Yeah. I thought it was great because you even addressed the person that says I'm going to cease to exist, right? Because a lot of times for myself, I try to but help people understand that, you know, life continues. But maybe I don't believe that. Maybe I believe I just cease to exist. So then, you know, the next question is, well, why would you fear that? Which I think is a really interesting thing, right? Why do you fear non-experience? But it's a human thing.
Yes, yes. And because fear, what's fear? Fear, let's define it quickly. So fear is the emotion caused by the anticipation of unhappiness. Mm-hmm. Well, if you were like my dad, you read the many stories about my dad.
Yeah,
in the book. I have a lot of stories in the book. So, my dad was the first belief system kind of person. He was a scientist guy, an engineer, and so forth. This is one life. My dad used to say, always had a cigar hanging out of the side of his mouth. He's like, just stick me in a box, throw the dirt on me, I'm done. That was my dad's famous saying. He would say it all the time.
Yeah.
I'm done. That's it. But I'm going to live my life. That's it. And you talk like this. And Asian American guy, when he talked like he's like from Brooklyn or something, I don't know, with a Boston accent. Anyway, but the thing is, I never fought him on it. I just said, yeah, that's fine. Just live your life, right? Yeah. And that's how what he did. Now, he didn't have any fears because he really was a full-on. I call it a full-on first believer, first belief system believer, because a lot of people are fence sitters, and that's why they have the fear. Because if you're really full-on, like he was, like you just said, you know, you're not going to have existence after if you believe that. Your mind's going to shut off. So what are you afraid of? Fear is the caused by the anticipation of unhappiness. He didn't anticipate any unhappiness because he's anticipating nothing happening afterwards. Other than, you know, worms crawling and eating his body. That was what he would say.
Right.
And so no fear. He had no fear. But most people have doubts about that.
I think that's a rare person. Yeah.
Yes. He was a rare guy in a lot of ways, my dad.
Yeah.
But most people I run into, they say they're the first belief system, but they're really a hybrid. They're like a first, second fence sitter, and that's very, very common. They have some fears. They have the what if. Okay, mm-hmm. What if? I believe the first belief. But what if? What if I'm wrong? You know, what if I continue? Am I just going to be, you know, awake?
Right. In a void.
In a void or whatever.
Yeah.
And so we unbundle that. But you know, a lot of times people, well, the other thing is, Brian, interestingly, if people will have the first belief system and they think that being afraid of how they're going to die is the same as being afraid of dying.
Yeah,
so I break that apart in the book too, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's a separate belief, the pain and suffering. Oh, I don't want to die this way. I just want to go quickly, and I have a fear about that. That's a different kind of fear than the fear of death. So we need to sometimes bifurcate and just separate these fears into what they are, because then we can figure out a solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your approach is very systematic, you know, so we break ourselves down what category in, and then we look at each one of those categories as to why do we fear. And then you say in the book, the ultimate goal is to help everybody live better in the now, no matter whatever your belief is.
Doesn't matter. You believe in a million, a zillion, a trillion, an infinite number of lifetimes. It does not matter. We are all here now. Let's live with our loved ones and our friends now fully. Enjoy our lives as much as possible.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, something I want to tell you about today. My podcast platform, Buzzsprout, has recently made it easier for me to allow you to support me financially. Go to www.grieftogrowth.com/subscribe. That's grief2growth.com/subscribe. And once you're there, you can sign up to support me financially. Now, you can do it for as little as $3 a month or, of course, as much as you'd like. If you do that, you'll get access to bonus episodes, and you'll see those in the regular feed. They'll have a lock on them. But when you become a subscriber, you'll actually get access to your own private feed, and you'll be able to listen to the regular podcast along with the bonus podcast for the subscribers. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for sharing the podcast. And I want to thank those of you who support me financially. Have a great day, and on to the episode. Yeah. So as I said, I started reading the book, and I'm like, I haven't read anything like this before. I'm a very rational kind of thinker, I think, and my background's engineering. I like to break things down. So I really, really resonated with the book, and I think it's important to understand, and this is my opinion versus saying this is or just inspiration, because a lot of times, when people get into tough situations, that's when that inspiration kind of falls apart. And having the understanding is something that can endure through difficult times.
Exactly. The inspirational approach is real. It's genuine. It's good. My experience is that it tends to be temporary.
Yeah.
It's often case specific. It's like, okay, I feel, I'm helped by the folks in this situation, and then another loss comes of any kind. It could be a death of a loved one, or it could be some other kind of loss. Mm-hmm. And the apple cart gets upset again. And that's the thing. So how can I help people? That's true of all my nonprofit work, is how can I help people long-term? How can I give them tools that empower them as independent beings to help themselves as much as possible? Now, I'm there as a support system to help people, you know, and mm-hmm. people call me all times a day, you know, text me, whatever, and I'm there. But how my goal is to help them be as independent as possible and freestanding, you know?
Yeah. Powerful. And you talk about in the book like a two-pronged approach. You talk about turning within, and we talk about understanding. We've talked about understanding. So let's talk about your turning within.
Yeah. So the turning within refers to finding a way, and each individual, each human being out there may have different ways of doing this. I don't tell them you got to do it my way. I'm not the one, my way is the highway guy. I'm not that guy.
Not at all.
Yeah. I'm an inclusive guy. So whatever works, I'm a pragmatist, you know, like you are as an engineer, where, you know, we're, you know, I'm the non-engineer in the family. Everybody else is engineers, like in the clan. So, but pragmatist. So whatever works, I'm the whatever works guy. So, but the turning within generally refers to the concept of going within ourselves somehow to find a way to go within and strengthen ourselves from the inside out. So I call it the inside out approach, mm-hmm. because we live in a world with so much the outside in approach. It's like, oh, how can I figure all of this outside here to make me feel better inside? And that's only a temporary fix, because if we are still feeling fully secure and stable and confident and whatever word you want to say inside, the external stuff is always going to change, and it's not going to be there all the time. Whether it's the really great job, I love my job. I'm not saying not love your job, but mm-hmm. but looking at that as your only form of inner stability is not going to work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're so externally oriented, money, cars, whatever, you know, all of that. So turning within means go within, find out who we are inside, connect with that in an easy, effortless way that is non-content oriented. Because again, external is all content oriented. So when I talk about turning within, I don't necessarily mean therapy. Therapy is a form of turning within, but it's still content oriented. And it's good. I refer people to therapists, and mm-hmm. they refer people to me. So mm-hmm. there's nothing wrong with it. It's just, as a distinction, it's different from what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Turning within. So I teach a meditation technique that I call turning within meditation. And it's a very easy process to turn within, connect with oneself, turn on the opposite of the fight or flight switch, which balances out all that brain chemistry, extra cortisol, extra adrenaline, lactic acid, and 40 to 60 other hormones and chemicals that get out of whack when we have the fight or flight too much. Right. So this turns on the parasympathetic nervous system, for those people who know what the medical term is. Mm-hmm. And so it automatically turns that on. People get balanced, and it expands the conscious capacity of the mind also as a side effect. Well, that's great, because then I feel more secure, not just inside from a brain chemistry standpoint, but from a mental emotional standpoint, more inner confidence, more inner stability, et cetera, more strength.
I love the way you described that in the book, and I hadn't heard it described that way before. So the turning within, the way I interpret what you said, it kind of builds a capacity for the understanding. So these two things kind of work hand in hand. If you do just one, just turning within, you're not really strengthening your mind and building that capacity. If you only do the understanding work, you're not really getting that grounding that you need.
Yeah, exactly. So the visual image that I give people sometimes in my talks, it's kind of like we have a container of knowledge, and then we have the knowledge, the content.
Yeah.
So the container is who we are, right? Our mind, our consciousness, our spirit, our soul, whatever you want, awareness. People use different words for the same thing. I use the word mind because it tends to be less culturally, you know, loaded. So the mind, we can expand the mind, the conscious container. This is mm-hmm. our container, right? And we can expand that outside of what we think this limited little thing our mind is. That's what I teach. That's what I encourage people to find a way to do. And then the understanding is the content, is the knowledge. Then the content goes in much easier because the container's bigger. And you can navigate that knowledge easier because the mind, the container is bigger, therefore more relaxed, et cetera, et cetera. Can reorganize the thinking easier.
Yeah, I love that. And there's one of the things in your book that you wrote about I really loved also, you talked about when your mother passed and your meditation, you said, just became crying sometimes. Right. I work with a lot of grieving parents, and I work with people that say, I just can't quiet my mind. I can't get there. I can't meditate. You know, I just can't do it.
Yes. Even in my classes where I teach a specific eyes closed technique, people do it 10, 15 minutes twice a day. That's it. Doesn't take long to do. And it's very easy. But even in that class, I tell people first that after I walk them through the step-by-step instructions, the first day, the second day of the class, I'm telling people, do not define your meditation based on the technique that I just taught you. Yes, the technique is valuable. It helps us get from point A to point B. But what I'm teaching you is a technique that allows you to let go. Let go of what? Let go of our emotional baggage, the overload, our balanced brain chemistry, allows to let go and expand our conscious capacity of our mind. That's what it's all about. So in your example, well, my example that you're citing from the book, when my mom died, I had already been meditating. I was an experienced meditator. I'd already been meditating for 12 years. I was an experienced teacher of meditation. I'd always been teaching for 9 years. I'd already taught 1,000 people to meditate before I was 30 years old. Mm-hmm. My mom died, and it blew me away because she was gone so quickly. It was not quite the same as her getting hit by a car, but it was almost like that because the cancer was so developed and she was asymptomatic right up to the end, boom, and then she was gone. So we had no clue. And then I was so close to my mom, I would sit and cry in my meditation. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I tell my students this, I've been telling my students this since then, since 1982, redefine that. That was my meditation. It would have been a forcing for me to try to do the technique. And one of the rules in the way I teach the turning within is no forcing. So I would have had to violate the first rule in order to, quote unquote, do the technique. So I said, no, I redefined. I said this to myself. I had an epiphany back in 1982. I didn't say this before when I was teaching before 1982. Right. I said to myself, Kel, that's your meditation. And I would get up afterwards. I was still sad that my mom died, but I felt 50 pounds lighter.
Yeah. You know, a guy that I've taken some, I studied Buddhism from, and I'm not a Buddhist, but I've studied it.
Right.
And he posted the other day, cause he's an experienced meditator. He said, you know, sometimes like today, my meditation was, my mind was all over the place.
Yes.
And I'm an experienced meditator, and that's okay. And so many people try to force themselves to get their mind quiet. And there's a, oh, I can't meditate. I'm a terrible meditator. I had a bad meditation today.
Yes.
And I like when you give people permission to, it's whatever it is. It's whatever the experience.
Whatever it is. It's a big misunderstanding that has come about over the millennia. And I've thought about this because, you know, that I've been teaching meditation for 46 years now. So I've got a lot of years to think about this.
Right.
But why is that? Why is what you just said so prevalent in the meditation world? And I've distilled it down to a couple things. One is that I think there's a history of using waking state rules, waking state metrics in meditation, which does not apply. Once you've been an experienced meditator, you realize it's not the same as waking state. Waking state, we need to focus. We need to control our mind because if we're driving through the intersection, we're going to get in an accident. If we don't, you're going to pay attention, right?
Mm-hmm.
Meditation, no. This is not the time to be precise and be paying attention. No, it's a letting go state of mind body. Well, you know, that's a fundamental distinction. And I tell people who have never meditated, and I tell them this. I say, why would you apply waking state rules? I mean dream state rules to waking state. You wouldn't, because in dream state you could be driving a car. In your dream, but in the dream, the car may turn into a horse, or it may turn into a teddy bear, or turn into a flower pot. Who knows what? It's not going to happen in waking state. Guarantee you, your car is not going to turn into a horse or a flower pot.
Right.
Pay attention in waking state. dream, we don't apply that. We don't mix rules like that. It's kind of, it would be illogical to do that. And yet we readily do that with meditation. That's what I've kind of distilled it down to, a misapplication of waking state rules in meditation.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love the way you put that, because I find myself, I've been meditating for several years now, and I put effort into it. You know, I still judge it.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. It's just sit there and whatever happens, happens. And that's your meditation for the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Now the difference is that there's a specific step-by-step technique that I teach that gives them something to quote unquote do in their meditation. But the big but is that I teach them that technique and give them tips around the technique and how to do the technique that takes less and less doing, if that makes sense. And it creates more and more flexibility. And I give them more and more permission as it relates to the specificity of the technique. So there's a specific technique, but there's, okay, but if this happens, then this. And I give them like a little bit of a flow chart. I don't tell them it's a flow chart typically, but you know, you're an engineer, you know what I'm talking about. You know, so I give them that and they say, okay, if this happens, then this is how you handle that. And if this happens, then that. But it's all geared towards less effort, less doing. That's the thing.
Yeah, that's great. And I have to say this quote, because it's one of my favorite quotes. I know it's on the back cover of your book. It's in the book. But the Woody Allen quote, I use it all the time. You know, I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that really gives us the distinction between the fear of death and the fear of dying. And I like the way you break those two apart, because they're not the same thing. People that have had near-death experiences, typically their fear of death is gone. I mean, it's just they don't have it. But they still might have a fear of their circumstances, of how they...
The how. Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi there. I'm really excited to tell you about my latest ebook. It's 4 lessons that you can learn from the near-death experience without going through all the trouble of dying to learn them. I've been studying NDEs for several years now. I am completely convinced that not only are they 100% real, but that there's some very universal wisdom that we can get from the near-death experience. And I've distilled that down in this book into 4 short lessons. And I've also given you all the reasons why I believe the NDEs are absolutely real. So go to www.grieftogrowth.com/NDE lessons to pick it up for free. www.grief2growth.com/NDE lessons. I hope you enjoy it. Looking at my notes here from the book. I just want to, you know, let people understand it's a really, it's a non-religious approach. It's not faith-based by any stretch of the imagination. So no matter what you actually believe, because you cover it all basically in those 4 belief systems and the hybrids, I think it can help people really overcome that fear that we have, which is, I think, a natural fear, right? We all fear the unknown.
The issue is not trying to get rid of the unknown, I tell people, is because the unknown or uncertainty is always going to be there. Yeah. We're gonna know. I tell people we're gonna know when we know, and you're gonna know, and I'm gonna know. Each of us gonna know at that most intimate moment of our lives when our physical body shuts off. We're gonna know either the light's gonna stay on, in other words, the mind's gonna continue, or the light's gonna turn off. One way or the other, we're gonna know. But what I want to do is help you live life now, get rid of your fears now, because if the light does stay on, then you will also, your now will be then, you know, then it'll be a different now, you know, that now for you will then be continuing if the light stays on, and I want you to be as fear-free as possible then too. So it's all about living in the continual present, because the present, you know, changes that. It's now that's the present. Now that's the present. Now that's
the present. It's always living in the now. That's all we have is the now. And that's the only thing we can focus on. It's the only thing we can control. Is where we are now. So if we can, you know, fear is always future based, right? It's always what's going to happen to me, and trying to predict that and trying to control that, which we have to let go of.
So fear we can get rid of. I can help people get rid of their fear. I cannot get rid of uncertainty. That's just part of the free will universe we live in.
Yeah.
But we can get rid of the fear.
Yeah.
And that's what gives us the ability to live our lives fully.
So we've covered the book, and I think it's really great. We've covered all the different belief systems. I want to talk about your belief systems now. So how did you get started in connecting with the other side?
Connecting with the other side. So I think the fundamental thing for me was really the turning within, the meditation that I learned back when I was a teenager. And I had an NDE when I was 20 years old, but I almost drowned. But I think that will to come back into my body and continue swimming back in when I was pulled two miles out by a rip current off of La Jolla near UCSD, that the will was very fundamentally, I think, based on the fact that I'd been meditating for several years before, because the fact that I was, in a sense, out of body was not a new experience for me, in a sense, you know, because I had those meditation experience. So I knew what to do. I knew that I had a choice also. And so a lot of people who have NDEs, that's the first experience they've ever had, really, where their mind-body is really separate, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I already had many experiences like that before, so it wasn't a new thing for me. So I thought, I felt much more in control, and I willed myself back. I just make a choice, and boom, and then back. That was the first couple of things that kind of impacted me. And then in my mid-20s, I started remembering past lives, and I'm not a spiritual book reader. I never read any spiritual books. I learned meditation only because I was stressed out. I was just max stressed out, and that's why I learned. I wasn't into spiritual stuff, but just all of a sudden started remembering stuff, and then on the communication with the other side happened about another 10 years later in the mid-80s. So it's been going on for a long time. So it's very seamless now. It's just, communicating with you is like, it's no big deal. And yeah.
So you started off doing meditation as a stress relief, as a secular thing, I'd say. And then you kind of developed into the spiritual connection. Is that correct?
Yeah. I totally learned solely because I was stressed out. I was really stressed out in college. But then it had all these ancillary side effects. The meditation, I'm like, whoa, my mind feels like incredibly huge. You know, what's that about? You know, So I started having these other what people refer to as spiritual experiences, but it was a complete surprise to me. And then the memories that go back now 6,000 years and stuff, that started opening up in my mid-20s, completely spontaneously, completely out of nowhere, just lying resting and. TV screen went on, and then boom. Yeah. Same thing with the communications from the other side, completely spontaneous. I wasn't looking for it. And then archangels, angels, and others and so forth, you know.
So this is just a regular thing for you now. Is that right?
Yeah. It's just a regular thing. It's like, I guess the doorway between the here and the there is not so, it's just more seamless now.
Yeah,
a normal thing, and so I have a normal relationship, I guess, with the other side.
Yeah,
but well, I'm fully here is the thing. I am all about living in the physical. I'm not into there's a lot of folks who out there who I run into from time to time who are like can't wait to get to this. It's like it's an escape thing. They feel like I'm finally going to get where I really want to be. I don't feel that. I feel like now that I have so much experience with the other side and obviously this side, I feel fully immersed in the here and the now, in my body, enjoying life here with who I'm with. Mm-hmm. And I am sometimes on the other side enjoying conversations, but they can wait. You know, I'm here with you right now, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's a great way to be. I think that's a fantastic way to be. And I think that that might be another byproduct of not having the fear of what is going to happen and to really fully understand, you know, who you are and your purpose for being here. I think a lot of people are lost. It's like, why am I here? Who am I? What am I doing?
Yeah.
And then we find out about this other side. And it's like, yeah, that sounds a lot better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I always say, as compared to what? So you're right. You know, if people are feeling lost here, then they feel like, well, it's the grass is greener thing. You know, it always feels like, think it's greener. Maybe it will be, maybe it won't be, you know, you just, you know, but we always, you know, we have that grass is greener kind of tendency.
Yeah. So what do you think the purpose is? Why are we here?
I think that it depends on the person. And I think the purpose of why we're here is to enjoy life. That's my view of it. Mm. Now, I may choose to have a certain purpose in the way Kelvin Chin lives his life and so forth. And I've not always done this work that I'm doing now. You know, I had a family of, you know, two children. It was four of us and so forth, and raising a family and all of that. I was in corporate America and legal work and so forth for decades, et cetera. I've always had an underlying emotional need, I guess, emotional drive to help other people. So even in those settings, when I was doing corporate work and legal work and so forth, I always, you know, funneled my energy through that filter, so to speak, you know, that prism of helping other people. And I did it in a way of as high integrity as humanly possible at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way I have chosen to live my life. So purpose, there's all kinds of purpose you could draw from that, right? But how we manifest that is very individual, up to that individual person.
Sure.
And so it really doesn't matter what, to me, I don't think, it matters what a person does, where they are on the social, economic, I don't know what you want to call it, but, you know, status food chain, right?
Sure. Yeah.
It doesn't matter to me. We as a human species, I think, spend way too much time on the what and not enough on the how.
Yeah.
It's the what's your title? You know, where do your kids go to school? How much money do you make? You know, where are you in that social economic status food chain? That's all what stuff. It's, to me, it's the how. How are you living your life? How do you interact with people? How do you treat other people? That's, to me, where the rubber meets the road, because, when, you know, I help people die too, literally die. You know, like I'm at their deathbed, right? Mm-hmm. And people, it's not like, oh, did you get that Ford 150 truck with the rear end that goes down by itself and whatever, all that stuff? It's like, who cares about that when you are dying at your last moments? It's really who have you impacted? Where's your loved ones? Are they there? Do you know what kind of life have you lived? That's what flashes through most people's minds. It's the how. But right. We get so caught up in the consumer of the what, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's an excellent point.
So the purpose to me is, if you want to call it that, I mean, purpose of life is how we live it.
I think it's interesting because, you know, you say it's to enjoy a life but a lot of people are not enjoying this life, in terms of human, you know, perspective, right? In terms of what's happening to us right here and right now. And there's a lot of pain and suffering in the world. So people are like, why am I going through this? What is the purpose of this pain? So yeah. I think those are questions that we naturally have.
Yeah. Yeah, I think those are tough questions, because when people are in a survival mode, then you are in survival mode. I've been there. Look, I've been laid off 5 times since I was 50 years old, trying to raise a family. But, you know, company gets sold, a merger happens.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, all of us are out the door because the big company, the company that's 5 times bigger than us, they already got 2 of me, you know,
right,
whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's tough. When you are in survival mode, I totally get it. You are in hunkered down, you're in the foxhole, and you are trying to figure out how to get from today to tomorrow. That's it. Or from this moment to the next moment in some cases.
Right.
And so, you know, that's not a time to me. And that's not a time for big time reflection, you know. Yeah. That's a time for for surviving. And that, and for me at that moment, that was my need to be, that was my now.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it wasn't a time for me to be spending all kinds of times reflecting on this stuff. I had to figure out how to get the next job, et cetera, in my case, or whatever the person's next thing is in their life. And so that's tough. And when you're in that kind of pain, whether it's emotional, physical, or financial, doesn't matter, it's pain. And we need to deal with that. So I think to the turning within point, that's what gave me the strength to kind of move on and not just curl up in a ball. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, 50, 55, again, I can't remember how old I was, 58, you know, whatever, 60 again or whatever, it happened again. You know, really? You know, another company got sold? Come on. But it happens. And, you know, it usually doesn't happen five times to people when they're 50, but it happened to me five times. And it's like, you know, you got to deal with it. So the turning within for me was the crucial element, because being strong from the inside out allowed me to deal with the crazy stuff that gets thrown at you sometimes externally. And nobody can predict that sometimes, you know?
Right, right.
Sometimes you can kind of see it coming, but often you can't.
And you've been teaching meditation for decades. You've been doing this for quite a while, but obviously you had another career in parallel with this. When did you make the transition to doing this as a full-time thing?
So I did it full-time in the 70s, and then I've been doing it full-time for about the last 7 years or so. Years again, mm-hmm. full-time. 30 different countries, mostly video conference. That way there's no cost to my clients around the world and so forth. And I do a free session initially for people on any topic and any subject, whatever, mm-hmm. initially. So it's part of my nonprofit work. But yeah, 6 or 7 years full time teaching this way. And sometimes I'm in person, but depends, you know.
So you teach, obviously, groups, and you also do one-on-one teaching?
Yeah. So mm-hmm. I teach sometimes people, their schedule is such that they don't want to wait till I have a group that coalesces. I teach groups every a month, usually, maybe every 6 weeks or something. Sometimes people just want privacy because they have so many personal issues that they want to talk to me about privately, that they just want the whole 4-day class. It's a 4-day class, about an hour and a half each day.
Okay.
For 4 days. And then with my higher anxiety, really depressed higher anxiety, I have clients with panic attacks. I have clients on all kinds of working closely with their own psychiatrists and psychotherapists and so forth who have various medications.
Mm-hmm.
Those clients, my more extreme clients that way, I work much more than just the 4 days with them. I work with them on a much more consistent basis whatever they need. I'm here to help them get over that hump, that bump in the road for them, whatever that is. And for some people, the bump has been there for 8, 10, 20, 50 years.
So obviously you do the fear of death and you also do grief teaching. So how are the two different? Yeah.
So different in the sense that the grief work can be around death and dying, but it can be around, I don't know, 30, 40 other different kind of losses you may have. I've worked with people who have had financial losses like I have had. I've worked with people who had divorces is another significant loss, as well as death of loved ones and so forth, of course. But there's all kinds of losses that people have had, and some of them are bigger, more devastating emotionally, and some of them are smaller losses, but they accrue, they build up. Like children, but it affects adults too. If you're moving around a lot, that's a loss because you the familiarity of that neighborhood and your favorite dry cleaner and the restaurants and blah 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 and everything. And now you're on the other side of the country or you're inside of the world living, who knows what, those are big losses. And there's a grief process that goes along with that that people generally don't recognize. Mm-hmm. So let me define grief to you, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about grief. So just very briefly,
mm-hmm.
Grief falls into two general angles of looking at grief. One is the overwhelming sadness that people can experience around a loss. And sadness is something that usually people do appropriately associate with grief and grieving.
Sure.
And the other is the conflicting emotions, the conflicting feelings that we have around that loss. So if we lose a loved one, maybe we got along with him or her during our lifetime. Maybe we didn't. There could be conflicting feelings there either way. Mm-hmm. And we carry those with us in those conflicting feelings. Even somebody who we loved and adored, maybe nobody has a perfect relationship all the time. And so there are going to be some conflicting feelings there, or maybe we didn't get to say something to them that we really wanted to say to somebody who we adored. And then we have a conflicting feeling within ourselves about having missed that opportunity. So there's all kinds of sources of these conflicting feelings is the point. Mm-hmm. That's another aspect of grieving. Now sadness and grief are not the same thing. I think most people conflate and confuse that. That's why I call it overwhelming sadness, because my mother is a good example. So you read all the stories about my mother dying and so forth and how close I was with her. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I had lots of grief when my mom died. I had overwhelming sadness and I had conflicting feelings, because my mom would say, "Kelvin, do not come visit me at the hospital. You're wasting your time. You got to be in studying your law books and blah, blah, blah." And so sometimes I would just go to see my mom because she's dying. She could be dead any day, any hour now. And she's telling me not to come. So I would go, and then she'd yell at me at her bed. I'd be at her bedside. I'd bring my books. She'd say, "Go down to the chapel and go down there and study in the hospital." Wow. And so when then she dies, and I'm thinking, should I have not listened to her? Should I have gone there more often? What all that, you know, conflicting feelings, right?
Sure.
But I don't have that anymore. I've moved through that. I've recovered through that. Mm-hmm. And there's a process that I take people through. Mm-hmm. But the sadness is no longer overwhelming. So it's not sadness per se. That's a mistake people make. They think, oh, you'll get over the sadness. No, I am still sad. You see me in front of, you may have seen on my website videos of me giving lectures to 200-300 people, talking a story about my mom, and I'll get choked up in front of 200 people. I'm sure. Still sad years later, 30-something years later. But it's the overwhelming. I'm not overwhelmed by the experience of the sadness anymore. That's the distinction.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because I think some people, before they go through grief, they think, okay, I ask me, when's it going to be over?
Right.
When will I be finished with the grief? Right. And it's like, right. You know, you're probably not going to get over the sadness. You're not going to
get over the sadness, but the grief, that's why the distinction between sadness and grief is important. Because another reason why it's important is people think, oh, if I'm not sad, then I've forgotten about them. I'm not honoring my memory of the person I love. No, it's not about that. The sadness continues. I've written about this, and I say, the depth of the relationship, the depth of the love you have had for that person who is no longer physically with you, is directly proportional to the sadness that you have and will have and continue to have. So the deeper that love, the more sad you're always going to be. But are you overwhelmed by it?
Yeah.
Do you lose yourself? That's what I mean by overwhelmed. Do you lose who you are in that sadness? That's what I mean. That's not good. And that's what I help people with.
So one of the questions you had when we were doing the prep for the interview, you said to ask about the structure of the afterlife. So I'm curious to know, what is the structure of the afterlife?
So there's a different structure in the afterlife. It's mm-hmm. we've heard many stories from people who've been there and come back and so forth.
Yeah.
And it absolutely is a different structure than here. It's non-physical, et cetera. But it's not completely, totally non-physical. Yes, don't have physical bodies, fluids going through and all that. But there's energy there. It's made up of energy. And so there's energy structure to it. So that, I call that structure. Because mm-hmm. from a physics standpoint, it's still structural in a sense from an energetic standpoint. So that we have an identifiable energy pattern. For example, if I saw you on the other side, you could choose to show me a visual of how I see you right now. Brian, that's right. I remember you. You know, I thought I recognized your energy pattern, but now you're right. And then you can get rid of the face, you know, the energy face sort of. And you know, it's kind of like a mask almost. You could throw up there to show somebody. But there's an identifiable energy pattern that we all each carry with us to the other side So we're recognizable to each other. So there is a structure, mm-hmm. and there's no punishment on the other side. Nobody gets punished. There's no structure to punishment, so people should relax about that. There's basically, it's what you want to do. It's kind of like R&R, rest and relaxation. It's vacation time to rejuvenate. And if you want to come back, you can come back. If you don't, you can hang. I've hung out there for a couple hundred earth years. Now, time is different on the other side too. So here's another point. People often will come back and they say, it's timeless. There's no time over there. Time stood still or whatever. You know, there's no time. Mm-hmm. That's a conflation because there is time on the other side, but it's just very, very, it's so different from our experience of time on earth that I can understand why people would confuse that and think, oh, it's time. But again, this is where my meditation experience, I think, has helped me, because before I started having these experiences on the other side, I'd already meditated a whole bunch. And so, and as you know, sometimes in meditation, your experience of time is very not the same as, you know, waking state, let's just
sure.
say. Mm-hmm. And so you get used to that, and then you're on the other side, you go, oh, I see why people think this is timeless. There's no time here. I get it. But time, to me, is not just a subjective experience. Time, I define time as a measurement of change. Right. It's what we call it's a measurement of change. Is there still change occurring on the other side? So talk about structure. Yeah, there's still change. It's just very different than the change that the timing of change on this side is very different from the timing of change on the other side. But there's still change because there's change exists when there is identifiable individuality. So in other words, time is a measurement of change. Change exists if there is individuality. My experience is we are still individual personalities on the other side, and there's identifiable ones and there's dead ones, and there's some angels who have never incarnated as humans before, and they're identifiable as individual energy patterns and so forth. And so there's individuality, and therefore it's not some like cosmic soup, let's just say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. There are a lot of, I think, common misunderstandings to the other side, which leads to a lot of the fear. Do you address some of this in your other book, in your second book?
Yes. Yes. Okay. I'm going to get it. It's been about two thirds, three quarters done for a while now. And I've been teaching so much. My teaching is ramped up, so I'm helping people, which is great. But it's kind of different. I thought my book would be done a year ago. You know, it's like, it's in this almost done stage. I just got to get back and I got to finish it and then edit it and so forth. But anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, well, because for me, my personal thing is, and I was reading the second belief, you know, continued existence, but fear of it. That was me. My life. I was raised as an evangelical, as a Pentecostal.
I remember seeing that on your website. Yeah.
Eternal torture and all that stuff.
Right. So
that had me in therapy when I was like 40 years old, you know, working through that issue.
Yeah.
Of feeling unworthy. And you know, what if I'm wrong? So it's a fear. I think, you know, some of us still carry, you know?
Yeah. No, I have a lot of clients in that who had that similar history as you. Here's the thing. Couple quick things on this, because I know we're getting close to the end, but the hour. But if there is a God, so I'll just say if, because as you know, I take the approach of, you know, there may be agnostics, atheists, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is a God, I say God knows God. We have to agree. I think everybody would agree that God is at least as smart as human beings. I would hope that he or she or it is a lot smarter than human beings, but at least as smart as human beings. Well, human beings already know that punishment does not change behavior. We already know that from hundreds, thousands of studies, sociological, psychological studies, right? It does not change, pure punishment without anything else, does not change behavior. So why would God do that? He knows that. He's not going to do that. So why else would God do that? Okay, if the other argument is he or she is a vengeful God. Well, okay, I'll give you that. That's a possibility. I'm a person of all possibilities in terms of the discussion.
Sure.
I'll give you that. Well, then that's somebody I ain't going to follow. Right. I'm not into a vengeful God. Now you can be, and that's okay. That's fine. I'm not trying to change your belief. But my belief is that if there is a God, God is all loving, et cetera, et cetera, and is at least as smart as human beings, therefore wouldn't be punishing people. The punishment makes no sense. So plus I've been on the other side, but I can't speak to that because that's my experience. So sure. So I use a more logical, rational approach talking sure. to people because yeah. it's not their experience. They haven't been on the other side like I have. So it makes no logical sense for them to for there to be a structural place of punishment.
Well, yeah, I had this argument with someone just the other day because I came out of that, and you know, she's like, "Well, if you're a parent, you discipline your child." I was like, "Eternal punishment is not discipline."
Yes, that's
punishment has no
thing.
Point.
No, that's different. You talk about behavior modification with consequences. That is a different thing than eternal punishment and damnation and whatever, however you want to articulate it from, you know, that perspective. Yeah, that's different. Yeah, and that's why I say that, actually, that's why I weave in. You hear how I said it. I say pure punishment mm-hmm. without anything else. That's what I'm saying. That, you know, you can have consequences and you can discipline somebody, whether it's a child or an adult, it doesn't matter. You can right. discipline somebody and hold them to consequences of their actions
sure.
in order sure. to help, you know, maybe change their behavior. But it can't just be purely locking them up yeah. because recidivism is, you know, I had just given this talk and I was attending a talk by the LA County, Los Angeles County District Attorney. And she was taught, she just happened to be citing the statistics on recidivism, you know, how quickly people are back in jail. And it was like 60% are back within 6 months. And then either one third or two thirds, I can't remember, but a big percentage of those 60% are back within 3 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like they're in jail in three weeks. It's like, you know, through purely locking people up. Now, if you lock them up and then you give them skill sets and you train them and you give them and you do some, you teach them to meditate, for example.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You teach them to deal with their stress. You teach them some skills to get a job when they get out of prison. That's a whole different scenario, okay? Right. You could say that putting them in prison is punishing. Okay, I get that. But you got to add to that if you really want to have behavior modification, right?
Right. And there has to be a chance of getting out. You know, yes. That's the thing. Like I said, the hell that I was taught was not redemptive. It was
exactly.
pure vengeance. And it was
exactly.
Yeah. And that, you know, that makes God less loving than we are because we wouldn't do that.
Exactly. Yeah. But so it just goes to the point that it makes logical sense to me that people made that up
yeah.
to control people. And it unfortunately works because fear is an incredible motivator and it's an incredible, you know, depressant to people. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So, I really enjoyed reading the book, and I want to put it up again so people can see it. Overcoming the Fear of Death through each of the four main belief systems. As I was reading, I was like, I wish I had written this book because I was like, this is great. This is exactly, you know, that's kind of the way I think. I think it's a very rational approach, but I think that could be beneficial to people who are dealing with this fear and don't even know what the fear even is, right?
Yeah. I tell a lot of stories in there about people who have communicated with loved ones mm-hmm. on the other side. Not just my stories, but I have other people's stories. In fact, most of the stories are not my stories. I tell more of my stories in the lectures that I give, but in my book, I didn't want the book to be about me. So it was a lot of more stories about other people's stories, communicating with people on the other side, et cetera. Another quick thing I want to throw in just while I'm thinking about mm-hmm. There is a story in there that you read about no smoking in heaven. It's called the segment. It's called No Smoking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that one, it came to me I'll just give the quick version for the audience. But the reason I want to tell this is because of death by suicide. I did not know how he died. He's a brother of a friend of mine. I didn't know when he died, where he lived. I didn't know how he died. And he came to me I told my friend Nancy, your brother came to me and he told me, no, there's no smoking here. And I didn't know what that was about. He gave me a personal message for her, but there's like two random things, no smoking here. And he showed me a picture a visual, like a video recording of him and you walking out of a San Diego nightclub off of Hotel Circle, off of Route 8 in San Diego. And you were laughing, and it was nighttime in the parking lot, and it was lit up, and you were laughing. That's all I know. And I had no idea why. And she said, oh, he hated cigarette smoke. In the 1980s, he'd go around before non-smoking sections. He'd tell people to stop smoking in bars and everywhere and piss people off. And she said, the last time I saw him alive before he killed himself by suicide 2 weeks later was I flew to San Diego where he lived. I didn't know where he lived. To visit him. And we went to a nightclub off of Route 8, Hotel Circle, and he sang karaoke and got a standing ovation. I'm getting chills telling you this right now. He got a standing ovation and they were laughing about it walking out.
Yeah, that's wild.
That's the last time she saw him alive.
That is wild. You know, and it's funny you tell that story because I was just talking with someone earlier today and her son passed by suicide.
Yes.
And she said she's only seen him a few times. And one time she saw him sitting in a recliner in her house.
Yeah.
Smoking. And she's like, what are you doing smoking? And he goes, it's not real. And it's just crazy that you just told that story because literally this was like an hour ago that you told me that story.
Right. Yeah. You can do whatever you want. That's the other structure on the outside. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
You don't have a physical body to worry about. Right. You can smoke whatever. It's not going to have a physical issue with your lungs. Yeah. But it took him 16 years. This is another message for your audience. It took him 16 years to communicate with his sister. And the suicide note was that she found later in a closet that she had thought she threw away because she didn't want to read it again. But she found it later after I told her this experience. She found it and it said, I'm going to get to you as soon as I can. I'm going to tell you, I'm okay. Yeah. And it took him 16 earth years.
And that's another point about how time is different on the other side. And again, for a lot of my audience, we have children who have transitioned. And so people will be impatient.
Yes.
And we think, well, why haven't they gotten to me? It's been 6 months. It's been 2 years. It's been whatever.
Yes.
And what I've been told is time just passes differently there. And the other thing is a lot of people ask, are they missing us? Do they miss us the way we miss them? And my understanding is they don't miss us the way we miss them because for them, it's like that.
Yep.
We'll be there soon.
Yes, we'll be there soon. But they do miss us. They do miss us, but not in the same way that we miss them, as I think
right.
the way to say it. Mm-hmm. Right?
It's not agnostic
missing. But there's genuine missing. But it's not the same. Because, like you say, their experience, when they go to the other side, they go, wow, I'm still alive.
Right.
I'm just in different form. You know?
Well, it's like, you know, when my daughter is in college, I miss her.
Yes.
I don't miss her like my daughter that's on the other side because I know she's going to be home soon.
Yes.
Or when someone leaves the house to go, like my wife's out right now, you know, I'll miss her until she gets home, but she's coming home soon. I think it's like that when you're on the other side, they're like, yeah, I miss them, but they're going to be here.
Yes. And so what does that go to? That goes to what I always tell people. We need to be in the present with our loved ones now and love them as much as we can, be with our friends, et cetera, because even though I've had 6,000 years of memories of past life stuff, and I have friends in this lifetime who I know when we've been together at different times over that period of time, it doesn't matter. I'm with them here now, and I don't know when I'm going to see them again,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that goes to a whole other thing about soul contracts. And we may have a contract and you, Brian, and Kelvin may decide to come together again next lifetime. But then your father gets shipped off to who knows where and my father's employer lays him off and he has to get a different job. And we're in different parts of the country. We don't get together for a while.
Yeah.
Even though we may have a soul contract because free will operates. Other people's minds are operating all the time. We cannot predict. We can sort of kind of predict increased probabilities, but it's all probabilities.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to give people how to reach you. I know your websites are www.kelvinchen, that's KelvinChen.org, CHIN, and www.turningwithin.org. And people can reach you that way. Is there anything else you want to say about reaching out to you?
Just go to the contact page and my calendar is there. And like I said, I do a free phone session with people anywhere in the world. And then just talk about whatever and see if there's a way I can help or not. Sometimes just one phone session, people feel great. And I connect with them. Others, I said, yeah, my fear went away. So it's like, okay, whatever. And then on the bottom of every page of all of my websites are links to the other websites. So if you get to one, you can get to all of them.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, it's been an honor meeting you. You're fascinating to talk to. I really enjoyed the book. When I got it on Saturday, I'm like, there's no way I'm gonna get through this. But I picked it up Sunday morning and I finished it in bed Sunday night.
That's awesome, Brent. Great. Thanks for having me. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Grief to Growth. Brian hopes that you find this episode helpful and will come back for future episodes. Brian's best-selling book, Grief to Growth, Planted Not Buried, is a great resource for anyone who is coping with grief or knows someone who is. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support it, there are three things you can do to help. The first is to share the podcast with someone that you think it will help. The second is to go to iTunes, rate, and review the episode. The third way you can support the podcast is by becoming a patron. Head over to www.patreon.com/grief2growth. That's patreon.com/grief, the number 2, growth, and sign up to make a small monthly donation. Patrons get access to exclusive bonus content and knowledge that you are helping to spread the message of grief to growth. For more about Brian and Grief to Growth, visit www.grief2growth.com.
Hey there, if you liked this episode, come on over and talk about it. Let me know what you liked. If you didn't like this episode, come on over and talk about it. Let me know what you didn't like. Go to grief2growth.com/community and look for Talk About the Podcast. I'll see you there.